WGB, K2RIW in the check net.
KC2WGB. Interesting, Dick. Interesting experiment. And you may be right. Don't know. Even running single sideband, you may not have enough voltage to... the balls are about an inch in diameter, and he can vary the distance between them, and it is an insulated yard arm, and he can get the spacing from like 1 centimeter down to a couple of millimeters, and I'm just surprised that he sees no action at all. I would think with, you know, clicking the mic or something like that, that transient quick pulse might do something, but okay, very good. I think we should go on to Paul. It's 11 o'clock, and that's it from the space report. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
John, you didn't describe how the RF energy is being applied to the balls. Is the RF energy coming out of a hybrid-like structure, like twin lead, and now the twin lead hooks up to the two wires hanging from the yardarm? Is that how he's exciting the balls with RF? Over to you, John.
Okay, well, he has a wire from each of the pith balls going up to the yardarm, and that's all insulated. Then those wires travel back to a point where they actually connect to an antenna connection that he modified a little bit, so he has an actual antenna so that he can see RF powers going there, and he can measure the RF power, so the radio is actually working, and he just thought that he'd see these pit balls move, and it's not happening, and it's not detuning the antenna.
Yeah, I'm assuming he's got everything impedance matched, but the so-called electroscope function of repulsion, it's hard to believe that the simple action of rubbing fur on a rod and bringing it near your electroscope, you're developing a significant number of kilovolts, like probably 10, 20, and 30 kilovolts is being developed. Sometimes you can make a spark with that rod, which will jump a gap of, a good fraction of an inch. 30,000 volts per centimeter. When you jump a gap of 1 centimeter, it takes 30,000 volts to do it. And you can sometimes do that with rubbing fur on a rod. So the voltages you're generating are much bigger than common sense would dictate. And so the electroscope is really running on lots of kilovolts. Not the volts that you come out of a transmitter with, not the volts that you come out of with an antenna receiving a signal. So we're missing the voltage by orders of magnitude as I see it, John. KC2WGB for any final, K2RIW.
Okay, well, I hope he's listening tonight. If not, maybe I'll get an email. But something for him to keep fooling around with. Maybe he can get enough voltage to do it. But I know if he puts enough voltage on, of course it's going to deflect, because he proves that by using static electricity it works. So he just thought it should work because it's in phase, and he can go positive, negative, and he can keep it in either direction, and just wasn't cooperating for him. But very good. All right, this is KC2WGB, back to you.
Yeah, good science experiment. And I think he's making it up because I don't think you and I are likely to find a lab notebook, so to speak, that tells you to do that exact experiment. It's a very unusual arrangement, but good common sense he's using. And the real laws of physics are always a little bit stranger than... The real world is stranger than you can imagine in many cases. Now, Proxima Centauri and a planet going around that nearest possible star, from one point of view, that's unusually lucky. I mean, they detected it by way of the rumble of the star. In other words, that planet going around that particular red dwarf star called Proxima Centauri. Let me drop it. That planet does not line up so that it goes directly in front of the star, so that we could see a slight dimming of the star due to the occulting phenomena. Very few stars line up that well. So the majority of the exoplanets we found are those very small percentage where the planet has a plane of orbit that goes directly through the star. And so very few do that. I think maybe only 1 in 1,000. So of all the planets we've discovered up till now, only one in a thousand have the right orientation that we can see the occulting phenomenon. And so Proxima Centauri is not one of those lucky occulters. They measured the individual spectral lines coming out of that red dwarf star and noticed that those red dwarf star spectral lines wiggled back and forth in Doppler shift on an 11-day cycle, telling them that there was a planet once every 11 days going around that star, that red dwarf star. So that's quite a discovery this week. At least it was announced this week. Tell us a lot more about this one, Paul, if you can. WS2N with the space report. Space report number, I think it's 215. You probably measure it as 216. I know, 216. You probably measure it as 217. Go ahead, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm at 216. First of all, I'm going to use the input out copy.
You sound quite good. You were going through the western input before, and you sounded very good that way also, Paul. As long as your antenna is aimed correctly, you have either choice. But it's good enough right now. Go right ahead, Paul.
Okay, I went back to the western input. Yeah, it was all over the board before, so I figured let me switch. So right now it looks okay. Yeah, Proxima Centauri. I was called the closest star Alpha Centauri when I was young, but then I realized that there were three stars there, and this is one of that group, Proxima Centauri, and it's a little over 4 light years from here, I think 4.25. So now they found this planet going around, and possibly another planet, by the way. They haven't confirmed that. And I first read about this a week or so ago. The one group, the Dutch group, came up with it. Wasn't confirmed. They used the European observatory down in Chile to look at this. And, you know, since it wasn't confirmed, I figured, well, let me let this ride. And then sure enough, NASA came out and they confirmed it. They backed it up. Let me drop it. Doppler shift is, yeah, I think they said it's something like 3 feet per second difference when it's coming, moving one way or the other. You know, it's close to star, so they can't use the dimming effect. But there is a possibility that the inclination might cross a little bit on one of the poles of the star at one point. They're looking into that, and they're hoping that they do at some point. I know it's an orbit every 11 days, and what you mentioned earlier in the net was about the radiation, so the probably strong radiation possibly creating a situation where maybe life won't exist on that planet. So it's going to be interesting to find out, and if they can get some kind of a transit out of it, they could either look at it with a test in the future, if it's going to be going up, or even with the James Webb Space Telescope, and they'll be able to tell from the spectra of that light. You know, you'd have the light going past the planet, past the atmosphere, if there's an atmosphere, and then they'll be able to tell what that atmosphere is. So they're all hopped up about this, and I hope it works out. There is a multi-billionaire. He's been funding this project. Let me call it. This project is called Project Starshot, and he actually comes out of Russia. He lives in Moscow, but he's already put a lot of money into it. He's going to put a lot more money in the future. Yuri Milner is his name is. And I guess he's probably, you know, one of the Amazon.com people like Bezos from Russia. So, you know, a lot of these billionaires now are involved in projects. And this is that's his baby. It's called Project Starshop. He's going to take a small nano craft. They're calling them. They're only going to be a couple of grand. And somehow, with laser beams, you know, from Earth, be able to push these off at 20% of the speed of light. And now that they found a planet, he's got a real target where he can do this. So he's planning on developing this system. And it would take roughly 20 years for these, let's call them spacecraft, to get to that planet. And then even once it gets there, to transmit a signal back would take another 5 years. And, you know, this isn't going to happen tomorrow. He's got plans, like, you know, 20 years down the road for something like this, probably. I haven't really seen a date on that. Let me drop it. So, you know, I'm trying to look into the theory behind doing something like that, actually having some kind of sales, you know, very fine, flat sales being pushed by laser beams. Accelerated to 20% of the speed of light. And he thinks this star system, because it's a little closer, he might be able to do it a little bit less than 20 years. He'll actually get to first planet in another solar system. So that was pretty cool. And that wasn't going to be my main story. I was going to talk about Juno, but this thing, of course, came up. Juno has gone into its second pass, its second orbit around Jupiter, and that happened actually Saturday morning. So it passed within a little over 2,000 miles above the clouds of Jupiter, which is very close, and it had all its instruments on, taking all its different kinds of readings, including camera. And they plan on getting that information back within a couple of days. We'll hear probably by the end of the week and see pictures by the end of the week. NASA will release those pictures. Let me drop it. Now, Juno is a spacecraft that launched about 7 years ago, and it's now in orbit around Jupiter. It went into its orbit on July 4th of this year. Fired its retro rocket for about a little over a half hour, about 35 minutes, to slow itself down. And, you know, by doing that, Jupiter was able to capture it into a 53.5-day orbit. And it'll do that one more time, another 53.5-day orbit. And then next time it comes around, they're going to fire that same retro rocket to slow it down even more, to get it into a 14-day mission orbit, and they'll do that for some 37 different orbits. At the end of that, after about a year and a half of operation, they plan on deorbiting the whole spacecraft into the Jupiter atmosphere. So that mission will be over. But it's in a polar orbit, which is very unusual. Galileo, which was there for about 5 years, was in an equatorial orbit. So we'll see what kind of science comes back from Juno. Let me drop it. Okay. Another topic that I think should be covered, because the date is coming up, September 8th. Is OSIRIS-REx. I've talked about it a couple of times here on the net, but OSIRIS-REx is a mission that is going to go to an asteroid, and it's another 7-year mission. It won't get to that asteroid until 2020. It'll launch this, you know, within a week or so, on September 8th, from Florida, on an Atlas V rocket in a 4-meter bearing. So it'll also have only one booster rocket to it, so it'll be a 4-1-1 configuration. And that will go out to Bennu, which is an asteroid that a little bit further than Earth, but less than Mars. I think it's 1.3 AU, something of that nature. And they plan on getting there, like I said, in 2020. And they have a robotic arm on the end of it. And they'll orbit it for about a year. And they'll make all sorts of observations and pictures. And they'll make a decision on what location they're going to use this robotic arm to suck up some dust. And it's a pretty interesting arm on how that thing works. Demonstrations of it on from NASA. So they plan on bringing some material back. They have a capsule on board. The robotic arm will put this material into, and then after about another...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The spacecraft will continue on around a solar path. WSQN, and the landing capsule is coming at like 23,000 miles per hour. They plan on landing that in the Utah desert, and then after doing that, they'll bring it back, and all the scientists will be able to see what they got. And mission that went out to a comet and didn't touch the comet. Didn't land on a comet, but it had a tennis racket-shaped object made of aerogel that picked up some molecules, stardust from the comet built. And after it left the comet built, it came back, and it came back in the same fashion. So it's a proven technology that they've done this before, and they'll be able to, hopefully it'll work, bring back some stuff from an asteroid. So let me drop it. I'll let it go for now. I know you wanted to talk about that one incident with, you know, does NASA have problems with radios, problems, worried about people with... I'm going to talk a little bit about Merritt Island, but I'll just quickly mention they had two dish antennas on Merritt Island that they always tracked the Apollos and every single shuttle for the first 7.5 minutes before the shuttle would transfer over either to another ground station or up to Tedris. The tracking data relay satellite. Merritt Island were discontinued after the last shuttle. And one of the reasons is that they eventually want to replace it, but they're going to actually move. They wanted to move it, but then they decided to destroy the big antennas, and they'll put up new ones. But SpaceX came along, and they said, before you destroy it, I'll buy them. And he picked them up from dirt cheap, and he's going to bring it to Boca Chica, Texas, where he's building a launch facility where he's going to be launching astronauts in the future from Texas. So that's where he's going to put these two 30-foot dishes. But the RF problem, they actually shaped the building, the visitor center in Cape Kennedy in a certain fashion, because the dish was pointing in that direction when the rockets were taking off. So it was that close. So in the future for the SLS program, Space Launch System rockets that will be eventually going to Mars. These are the rockets that are going to be bigger than the Saturn V rocket. When those rockets start going up, they'll be using different antennas from a little different location where they won't worry about having RF go near the visiting center. And those antennas operated on S-band, by the way. They're voice and some TV video that you come across. They're decommissioned for now, and all the other flights, the manned flights that are going to be going up, those companies, SpaceX and Boeing, will be responsible for the communications with the with their own spacecraft. Of course, they'll use Tigris and everything, but they'll have a different system than what NASA had. Back to you, Dick. Any questions? There's plenty more, but I'm not going to keep going on. Just another topic. This is WS2M for the space portion of the TechNet. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, some of that's pretty interesting stuff, Paul. Let me make sure I've got the thing set right here. And I hope I'm not over-modulating. And I'm checking the... Sure enough, that's 975-375 repeater. It did go off for a short period of time, but we managed to reset it. When it comes to the Proxima Centauri planet, the most recently discovered planet going around that particular red dwarf star with an 11-day period. So it goes around the star all the way in 11 days. And this rich guy is going to send out there a whole bunch of these micro-sized satellites that are going to be going a good fraction of the speed of light and get there in a hurry. And he wants them to send back a picture. Now think about that. At first I thought this is way beyond, and then I thought of a way he possibly can do it. Right now the deepest piece of hardware you and I know about is Voyager. Voyager is 12 billion miles away, three times the distance to Pluto. That sounds like it's pretty far. You calculate what percentage that is to Proxima Centauri, and it's like the first step of a very long journey, if you know what I mean. Even though Voyager has gone very far, it hasn't even gone 1% of the way. I don't think, we'll do that calculation, but I don't think it's even gone 1% of the way. And it's 37 years. Let me drop.
It would take 50,000 years, they said.
Okay, so 50,000 versus the 37 that we spent, that's roughly 1,000 to 1. So a little bit more than 0.1% of the way we've gone there, if you know what I mean. And right now, Voyager is so far away from the sun that it is not slowing down very much, if you know what I mean. It's not seeing very much solar gravity way out there. But Voyager talks to us. That's the good news. It's using a 6-watt transmitter into a 12-foot diameter dish aimed to the nearest 1/10 of a degree beam width, 1/10 of a degree of accuracy aimed at the Earth. And with 6 watts into a 12-foot dish, we're way down to like 50 bits per second it communicates with us. If you want to send, if Voyager, let me drop. If Voyager wanted to send us a medium resolution photograph, boy, it would take you weeks of time at 50 bits per second to transmit that signal. 12-foot dish, 6 watts. So he's going to send out there 1,000 times further distance, a whole bunch of these little microsatellites, and they're going to RF talk to us, or laser beam or whatever, they're going to talk to us. Not a chance. But there's a catch. There's a possible way. If he sends a zillion of those satellites out there, and he sends them at different velocities, so that at the time you want to send data back, you've now got a string of them, where each one of them is, let me pick a number, 1,000 miles apart. And so now each one of them is relaying the signal. The problem with sending a signal back from a very long range is inverse square law piles up into big numbers. Voyager is overcoming 315 decibels for free space loss. So the dish that's doing the transmitting and the dish that's doing the receiving has to overcome 315 decibels. That's just for 12 billion miles. You go 4 light years, I don't know what the number is, but maybe it's going to be 500 decibels of free space loss. That number, because you're talking in decibels and it's an exponential function, it's real easy to say the number. Let me drop. You try to make a transmitter overcome amount of space loss, you better have a lot of kilowatts of power. You better have a really big dish that's doing the transmitting. And even then, you're going down to millihertz of bandwidth out of the receiver in order to get that signal above threshold. So to directly transmit with these microsatellites at Proxima Centauri, send us data or a picture back, out of the question. Unless you've got a relay function. If now each one of them is a small distance apart, and the signal gets relayed through all of them, and you got to worry about that. You're relaying now through thousands of these satellites, and if any one of them fails, the signal, you know, the chain is no stronger than the weakest link. So if he's making a chain of satellites, I think he stands a chance. But to transmit directly for zillions of decibels is way beyond the laws of physics as I see it. I don't think he's given any explanation yet as how these microsatellites, each one of them is a gram or a fraction of a gram, moving at a fraction of the speed of light to get there. I wonder, what details do we have so far in this one, Paul? It's an interesting science experiment. Even though he's got billions of dollars, he's still got to obey the laws of physics. NS, here we go. WS2N, K2I, W, go ahead, Paul.
Now, he's been working on it for a while, but now, of course, this came out. He's going to probably go full speed ahead now. So, he's got to develop some kind of laser transmitting system from our universe, from our solar system to get him going. I don't know if it's going to be from Earth or from space. Or probably have to be from Earth to develop that kind of power. But, I don't know, NASA has their own system. They call it Deep In. It's NASA's Directed Energy for Relativistic Interstellar Missions. And that's another one of these wafer sat type of programs. And some kind of a probe that I don't know if they're going to be done with lasers. Or, I know communications are supposed to have optical communication with the NASA system. But we'll see. You know, it's just something that came up probably because of this planet that was discovered. And, you know, all these years they've been looking at Alpha Centauri and this one. And they never saw anything. And but they get better and better with the equipment that we're building. And I'm sure they'll be able to see something with James Webb or with Tess. But as far as, you know, getting these spacecraft out there and predicting that they're going to get this there in 20 years and have another 4 or 5 year transmission to come back, you know, 25 years down the road. Figure if they could launch this maybe in 20 years, I don't know. You got to be around 45, 50 years from now to find out if this ever works. Back to you, Dick.
I just did a quick calculation. Voyager talks to us at 8.5 gigahertz using a 12-foot diameter dish. A 12-foot diameter dish at 8.5 gigs has got 48 decibels of gain. It's the good news at 60% efficiency. It's got a beam width of 0.67 degrees. 0.67 degrees happens to be 40 minutes of arc. And that's the total beam width, and it's got to be carefully aimed at the Earth. If you aimed it 0.3 of a degree to the right or to the left, the signal you would get would be 3 dB down. Half power beam width is total of 0.6 degrees, so it's plus or minus 0.3 degrees. So you've got to aim that to the nearest 0.03 degrees if you want to get full power back to the Earth. So very precise aiming is required. Let me drop. Now, if Voyager was talking to us with a laser beam, the nice thing about the laser beam is you can get a very tightly bundled signal precisely aimed in some direction. So lasers are capable of giving you very long-range communication if it's very precisely aimed. A laser's got a long range because it's a tightly collimated beam. A tightly collimated beam if it's aimed at Mars instead of Earth, Earth hears nothing, per se. So, even though it may have a laser communication system, which in theory has got long range, where in the world does that extremely precise aiming take place? We're talking about milliseconds of arc of precisely aiming that laser. So even with laser communication, that doesn't solve the problem. I think his best solution is a chain of satellites that relay the signal. Because that's sort of what's going on nowadays, that we're starting to move from fourth generation to fifth generation cell phones. Let me drop this. If you can put your cell sites, instead of 6 miles apart on hexagonal pattern, you put them 3 miles apart, 1 mile apart, all of a sudden you get a lot higher signal-to-noise ratio, and you get a lot wider bandwidth, and you can transmit a lot more gigabits of data per second. But now, in order to put cell sites a mile or a fraction of a mile apart, no community would tolerate that. Unless you put micro cell sites on tops of a whole bunch of utility poles. And that's what's going on right now. They're setting up a lot of micro cell sites. So if you make the range of the radio path short, you can get away with a lot lower power and a lot greater bandwidth. But now you have to set up a whole lot of them. So I can't believe he's got the ability with these micro satellites to aim a laser beam precisely enough. I think he's going to do it with RF by relaying. And so, if he's got enough of them in that chain, then each one is transmitting off over a fairly small... Let me drop it. Each one is transmitting to a fairly small distance, and now a small amount of power and a small amount of aiming accuracy can do it. But now the chain is no stronger than the weakest link. If you've got 1,000 of these things set up as a chain between here and there, and the middle one goes dead, or the middle one has the wrong spacing, and it doesn't pick up the signal, then we don't get anything. So that's an extremely difficult problem. And I guess right now, some of those details haven't been given to us. When it comes to OSIRIS-REx, going to take a sample of that asteroid and bring it back home. That's an interesting project, because these asteroids have been sitting out there for billions of years. They don't have weathering like we do on the Earth. I mean, to try to figure out what happened, what was the sun like a billion years ago, let me drop it. You'd like to think you can dig down deep enough in the layers of soil at the Grand Canyon and find out what the sun was like a billion or 2 or 3 billion years ago. Well, there's a lot of weathering taking place on the Earth that's wiping out your data. Now you have to sort of reverse engineer what did the weathering do, and is there any of the original signal left? But when you're taking a sample of an asteroid, you're taking a sample of something that was part of the original stuff that was in the cloud that became this star, these planets, and these moons. So you're looking at very, very early raw material. I think that's part of the motivation for gathering a chunk of a asteroid and bringing it back home. It's a way of finding out what the past of the sun and the solar system was like. I think it's part of what's going on here, Paul. And by the way, I think the best way to really get good data, to get a picture from Proxima Centauri, let me drop it. To get a picture back from Proxima Centauri strikes me as an extremely difficult project, with only a zillion ways it can fail. However, when the James Webb Space Telescope is put into orbit, and it can look through the clouds with infrared, and it's got this huge mirror that can give you a high-resolution picture, and maybe there's ways of using it as a coronagraph, because the red dwarf is nowhere near as bright as an ordinary star. So the amount of rejection of the starlight requirement is nowhere near as big, and therefore the chances of doing direct imaging of the planet is possible. And as it comes near the star during almost occulting it, you now see the starlight going through that atmosphere, and by looking looking at the change in the spectral lines, you get some strong hints as to what the atmosphere consists of. How big is the atmosphere and what it consists of? So I'm beginning to think we're going to get the most amount of data in the next decade by James Webb as to what's going on at Proxima Centauri. WS2N, K2RIW, Red Bull.
Once that test gets up there, I'll get a good view of the star. If it does have any kind of a transit, I think Tess would be able to pick that out. So OSIRIS-REx is going to be a good mission, but we're going to have to wait quite a few years to find out if it was successful. The Japanese have tried to do something similar to this called a Hayabusa. They brought back just like dust from one, you know, it just didn't work out that good. So they send out Hayabusa 2, and it's in the process of going to another asteroid. This one, Bennu, is a pretty good size asteroid. They needed something pretty big because they wanted to be able to orbit it, and they needed something spherical, preferably. Makes for a better stable orbit, so they chose this thing. It's around 500 meters in diameter. So, it's not a small asteroid. And it's actually considered a near Earth orbiting asteroid. And you're going to check out the Yudkowsky effect. You want to see how the light affects the motion of the asteroid. So they got, I think 6 or 7 or 8 different instruments on board, including an 8-inch telescope that's going to be looking down on the asteroid as it's going around. So they're going to get some very fine detail. And by the way, I don't want to forget that supernova that John brought up a couple of weeks ago. Somebody had it in their questions, and turns out John and Roy sent him.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Not in our galaxy, but a different galaxy. We dropped it. When I first heard about it, I thought maybe this is something we could see visually, but they're using telescopes to see this. So I'm not sure what the big deal is. I know that they find supernovas now every couple of days. They look at the billions of galaxies. So I haven't really figured out why this one is being singled out by anybody. They use the supernova now as a candle for telling the distance, and not only the distance, but in the long run, the speed of a galaxy moving away or coming closer to us. So, I basically had that information that you guys sent, and nothing additional. Back to that WS-12.
Yeah, one of the things that they're seeing now on almost a daily basis, I believe, are gamma ray bursts. These things are typically a fraction of a second long. You have reason to believe they're coming from very long distances, many galaxies away from us. Some kind of a phenomena is going on in these galaxies, and it's coming from all possible directions. So one of the mysteries, I don't think they've got very much hard evidence yet as to what is a gamma ray burst, and are they related to what used to be called quasars, quasi-stellar objects. Those quasi-stellar objects, they used to think it was a very bright star very far away, and I think they're now finding out that what used to be called quasars, let me drop it. Are really complete galaxies that were first being formed after the Big Bang. So when you get a great big cloud of stuff coming together, forming a galaxy, and a whole lot of stars are lighting up all at once. And some of them are supermassive stars that are about to become supermassive black holes. So in the beginning, you get a whole lot of very bright, violent energy of the very early galaxies, very large early galaxies that were quasars. And that's my understanding. I might be wrong on this one. But are they related to these gamma ray bursts? And for all we know, the gamma ray bursts are actually coming from galaxies that are beyond optical range, where you can't even see them. But they're radiating so much energy in such a brief period of time that we see the gamma ray bursts. So there's a lot going on out there. Understanding it all is not easy. It's only going to take multiple lifetimes to understand a little piece of it. So, I believe now they've discovered some very... what I think you're telling us, Paul, is that there's a very large galaxy, very, very bright, very far away, that's being detected. And maybe it was being picked up by Hubble or gamma ray detectors. Correct me on this one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
It was picked up by something called the All Sky Automated Survey for Supernovas. This is what this thing does. But again, I'm not sure why this one is so different than the other ones. That's why I can't figure out. This comes from Galaxy M66. I don't know, they said it was some sort of light years from us. That's out there. You know, so I think they find these all the time. I just don't know why this one became important. I mean, we know where the galaxy is. It's only 35 million light years from here. You know, we see galaxies now billions of miles away, and they see supernovas going off in those galaxies. Maybe because this one is relatively close. I think I remember seeing a show one time where they said if one of these supernovas went off in our own galaxy, it would be as bright as the sun or something. So, but this we can't even see. Back to you, Dave.
Comment.
Yeah, you said 35 million miles. I think you meant 35 million light years. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
That's right.
KC2WGB. I believe I remember reading one of the things that were not ordinary. This happened with a clear atmosphere. There was no gas blocking it, no dark energy, no nothing at all to disturb it, and they were able to get some great...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Now repeat your last transmission, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, I think one of the reasons why it was written up was they found that it's unusual. There was no gas blocking it. There was no obstructions at all. They were able to get some great photographs. I think that's one of the reasons why they singled this out. Other than that, I think the article was poorly written as far as information.
I concur. And they said the star was between 8 and 50 times. You know, it's a big spread. Back to you, Dick. I'll be listening.
Yeah, correct me on this one, John. I believe beyond 11 o'clock, the timing of this repeater goes into a different timing, and we get different beeps. And we got to be careful about timing it out. It's a lot more easy. And I think it's got another kind of timing beyond midnight. Is that part of what Eric was working on earlier? KC2WGB, K2IW.
Yes, after 11 o'clock, we do not get the four beeps. We only get one beep. But after 12 o'clock, 12:07, that's when it starts to freak out as timeout. Sometimes it'll run, a minute. Sometimes it'll run 10 seconds. Sometimes it'll run 2 minutes. It's all over the place. Eric knows what the problem is. He hasn't come up with a good fix yet, that's all. But he's very aware of it.
Beyond midnight, if in between each transmission we don't just wait for the beeps, but we let the machine completely drop,
makes no difference.
That was my question. So even if we let it completely drop, it still randomly goes to a 10-minute time schedule, so I think a 10-second time schedule is what I think you're saying, John. Go ahead.
That's correct, Dick. Sometimes it'll go the minute and a half, but most of the time it's around 20 seconds. And it's quite annoying, but and it makes no difference. You let the tail drop completely, and then wait a couple of seconds more. You come up, and maybe you're on 5 seconds, and it trips out. It's really crazy.
It's got a random number generator deciding how long each transmission is going to be before a dropout. As crazy as that sounds, there is a random number generator built into the protocol of a number of the RFID tags. In order for the tags not to be talking on top of each other, there's a protocol where there's a built-in random number generator as to when the tag sends back information. And so if you're looking at a field of 500 tags all at once, very few of those will be crashing communication because they're all transmitting the data at random delay times by the built-in random number generator. That's built in intentionally to that tiny little chip that you can just barely see without a microscope that's on some of these modern-day RFID tags. Let me drop. You can put individual RFID tags on each of the items that are on a pallet that you're moving with a forklift truck. You picked up this pallet of stuff, you know, it might be 6 foot high, 3 foot square. You're picking up this pallet, and as the pallet goes through the docking doors of your warehouse, the docking doors have a RFID reader aimed at the pallet, reading all of those tags. There might be 500 tags there, and in theory, you can read them all within about a second as the pallet goes whizzing by on the forklift truck. You see the value of properly run RFID, radio frequency identification tags. Each of the things that are on your pallet, you'd like to know what it is, where it came from, what is its date. Let me drop. And a hell of a lot of that data could be programmed into each of those tags. It's either programmed into the tag itself, in some cases, because the tag can have 97 bits of information, an ordinary tag, or because you know the serial number of the tag and you've got a computer database somewhere else, you know that serial number represents this item made at this date by this manufacturer and has gone through this many ports in the process of it being shipped to the United States. Lots and lots of information. And as I said, the little black dot that you just barely see with the naked eye without a microscope is at the center of this 900 megacycle dipole that's about 4 inches long, that is the RFID tag. That's a printed circuit antenna. There's a lot of sophistication in those things. And it's thoroughly passive. There's no battery on board. It never wears out. In theory, you can look at it 10 years from now, and you'll get all the data with the same fidelity 10 years from now. And some of those tags can be rewritten. I think when you combine computers with radio equipment, I think there's a lot of history. There's a lot of potential benefits from doing that. It's got a lot of capability. It may develop into something. That's a joke.
Dick, if I remember correctly, Eric didn't explain the whole thing, but I think that the timeout feature is keyed by the courtesy tone. And after 12:07, we lose the courtesy tone. That's when it loses its reference as far as starting the clock with the timeout. It gets confused. That's my understanding.
That does sound like a good guess. So, I think you said, Paul, there was at least one other item you can give us with reference to the space report. And we've got 9.5 minutes or so. You can go to the next item if you'd like to. WS2N, T2RIW.
Okay, yeah, there's these researchers in California that have developed these plasma rockets, you know, similar to ion rockets, a little bit more powerful, but they have problems with the rockets, and they, you know, over time, they eventually degrade the wall, the inside wall, and these rockets would be used, you know, like a second or third stage in a, let's say, a manned mission or a cargo mission going to the outer planets. The idea is to have something with a better specific impulse number than what they have with chemical rockets. Chemical rockets, you just need so much weight of fuel to do a job to get these things out to the outer planets. For instance, we have Dawn going around. Cirrus right now, it was around Vesta many years ago. It was orbiting Vesta and it deorbited. Now it's orbiting Cirrus, and it's the first spacecraft to do that, to go around something and then go somewhere else. But you need these rockets. Let me drop it. You need to develop these rockets, and NASA's working on different systems besides chemical systems. Well, apparently this one group has figured out a way to protect the chamber of the rocket, even so it's taking a plasma and shooting it out the exhaust very fast, plasma being ions, positive ions. A lot of the ions were also hitting the walls, so over time, over a couple of years, you could degrade the wall and eventually the rocket will stop working, and now you're stuck in outer space somewhere with no control to go anywhere, slow down or speed up. So this one group has figured out a way to compensate and have the walls rebuilt. Apparently it looks like they're using negative electrons or something to compensate for this whole process, where the walls will be protected. And to make a long story short, they're calling these rockets immortal rockets, because the walls will last forever, the chambers will last forever. So I thought it was interesting. NASA has their own systems on doing things that's the nuclear system that they're going to start working on again, called NERVA. NERVA is a nuclear-based type of rocket, and NASA wants to use, but they might eventually use these things if they can develop these things properly. Immortal rockets, they call them. Back to you, Dick.
That's a catchy name. What do you do to the surface of the rocket engine that stops the plasma from eating away the walls? What makes it immortal? You may have said it, and I may have missed that one, Paul. Go ahead.
Apparently it's some kind of system with the negative electrons. I was reading it, and I didn't quite grasp it, but this all comes out of the University of California. And one particular guy is some kind of an expert with this. I'll have to read it a little bit more. But, to make a long story short, he's working on it, and it's going to probably over double the amount of, they call it, impulse, a second impulse. A good one is around 300. This thing could probably get up to 800 second impulse. So I'm going to look further into it, but I went to a couple of reliable websites, and then NASA was actually talking about it, but NASA was talking about their system. It's called the NERVA. The NERVA is a nuclear engine for rocket vehicle application. So what they plan on doing is having, they got plans drawn up for this, NASA does anyway, a large hydrogen tank, and then they have a nuclear furnace on board that heats up this hydrogen and blows it out the rear at a very high speed. But within the same article, they talk about this immortal engine. So that's just what I'm interested in. It's like a super ion engine that they're coming up with. And they apparently have successfully...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And it's called ISP. That's what they're trying to improve, the seconds of specific impulse. And, you know, if they could double that or triple that, you know, it could make trips to Mars. You could probably cut back on, you know, 3 or 4 months instead of 7 months.
When it comes to the efficiency of a rocket engine, by definition, is squirting some stuff out the back, and by Newton's third law, action and reaction, you end up with a force being generated. That force is usually measured in units. You and I would call it pounds, but the metric people call it newtons. Each newton is something like a quarter of a pound force. Well, what's the definition of a newton? Kilogram meter per second squared. In other words, if I had a 1 kilogram mass and I accelerated at 1 meter per second squared, that's my rate of acceleration. Each second, it's moving 1 meter per second faster. That's why they call it 1 meter per second squared. So a newton is one newton is 1 kilogram meter per second squared. So that's the force in basic units being generated by your rocket engine. Let me drop. Depending on what kind of a rocket engine we're talking about, and depending on how much fuel you got on board, it can do that force generation for a certain length of time before it runs out of fuel. Well, the fuel you're using is measured in kilograms. So when you multiply it all together, the amount of fuel you use per second to generate how many newtons of force during each second, you put it all together and multiply it out, it ends up as seconds or seconds squared. So the unit of efficiency of a rocket engine is called specific impulse. The unit of specific impulse, I think, is either seconds or seconds squared. I think it's seconds. So a rocket engine that uses less fuel to give you more force is going to get a bigger number of its efficiency, which is called specific impulse. So, you can have a lot of fun with these units. When it comes to just the units of magnitude, I sometimes have fun with my buddies by asking them, how many nano kilo megabucks do you have in your pocket right now? If you multiply that all out, a nano kilo megabuck is $1. Or I sometimes say, I don't use these small units of nano kilo megabucks. I use mega pico dollars. Well, a mega pico dollar is again $1. Or you can combine teras and gigas and megas and millis and micros and nanos. You can combine these units. Now, if you're really following all the rules, let me drop this. You're not supposed to be combining units that way. But if you're a person just learning the metric system, you can have this fun. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1676, if I didn't, 1616, and Space Report number 216 of the series that began in September of 1982. John, Paul, and I